There's a very interesting article written by Bruce Porter. If you go to scrap.ca, you'll find his discussion on claiming adjudicative space. Bruce Porter was in Hamilton recently. He gave a talk at the Spectator, and later in the evening, he gave a longer talk open to the public. I managed to capture most of what he had to say and the panel that followed him. Today's show, we listen to Bruce Porter and claiming space for people living in poverty.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
But that they aren't looking at a human rights standpoint is quite sad. Because if we lose touch with this commitment to basic human rights standards, if we lose touch with hearing the experience and the voices of the people who are affected by these kinds of policies, then I think we are facing a kind of human rights crisis that has to have a human rights solution. It's very interesting that Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize-winning economist from India, who has really influenced our understanding of poverty and hunger quite strongly. You know, we used to think that, even in Canada, we tended to think, well, homelessness, it's a problem of housing, we need more housing, so we've got to build more housing to deal with the issue of homelessness. And we thought of famine in developing countries, certainly. Well, there wasn't enough food, you know, there must have been a drought. Amartya Sen studied famine in developing countries and found that, in fact, it's much more complicated than that. It's not a scarcity of food, there is actually enough food. It's the broader system, what he called an entitlement system. So it's, you know, the property laws, the programs, the development aid, how much people are paid when they're making minimum wage. In Canada, how much they get on social assistance, what it takes to qualify for employment insurance, the old age security. This is the complex system, and if that system is not ensuring that people can feed themselves or that they can get adequate housing, then we can call that an entitlement system failure from a human rights standpoint, because they're not getting what they need to basically live lives of dignity. And the solution to these problems, what Amartya Sen discovered, is that the problem was that the people for whom the entitlement system was failing had been devalued as human beings. Their fundamental rights had not been adequately respected, and somebody along the line decided to make a decision that left this group of people without food. In developing countries, it left them starving. In Canada, it's leaving people hungry. It's very much the same kind of phenomenon, though, of devaluing certain people, devaluing certain segments, communities, and allowing decisions to be made which end up departing from our basic commitments to human rights. So how did this happen? And is it really any different? Yes, it is different. When we ratified the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, no one had ever heard of a food bank. The whole word would have been completely foreign to people. The idea that we would have 900,000 people relying on food banks, on charity for food every month, just unthinkable. Homelessness, we guaranteed the right to adequate housing in 1976. I've looked at the literature on homelessness at the time. Homelessness meant then single men, transient, living in flop houses in large cities like Toronto or Montreal. The idea of like shelters across the city, across the city and across the country, overflowing with families, with children, unthinkable. When we adopted a charter in 1982, and women and people with disabilities fought for an understanding of equality that would really mean something to us, that would address the fundamental equality issues that they saw in Canada. And it was the International Year for Persons with Disabilities. We were the first constitutional democracy to entrench the rights of people with disabilities as a constitutionally protected right. And that changed our understanding of equality, because it was no longer just an issue of making sure that people weren't discriminated against through blatant stereotypes, but it meant that you had positive obligations to ensure access, inclusiveness, address barriers. It meant programs. That's what we called substantive equality in Canada. And it meant a lot to people. When I've looked at the submissions at the time in the early 80s from women's organizations and anti-racism organizations, youth organizations, they were all talking about social and economic rights. They were talking about access to meaningful, to decent wages, to deal with housing issues. And this was when these problems were not anywhere as severe as they are now. this is what we expected from our charter, from the just society that Trudeau talked about when he advocated the adoption of the charter, but we haven't got it. Instead, we've moved backwards. And so this idea of aggressively moving forward that is supposed to be our obligation under international human rights law, we've moved backwards. And for no really good reason at all. We could very easily as a society continue to be committed to these two human rights values. We could decide almost overnight that certainly when we're making basic decisions about how much people get on social assistance, that it's going to ensure access to necessities. At the time that we adopted the charter, we still lived under the Canada Assistance Plan Act, which required provinces, in order to get cost sharing from the federal government, to meet basic requirements when they set the level of assistance. And if they didn't set the levels of assistance to a level of adequacy, a person relying on social assistance, it happened to be Jim Finley from Manitoba, who became kind of a hero to our movement for doing this, but he went to court and said, well, if there's an agreement between these two levels of government that they're supposed to be providing an adequate level of assistance, and now they're clawing back 5% of my assistance, isn't that in violation of the agreement? And the government said, he has no business in here. This is an agreement between two levels of government. It's got nothing to do with Jim Finley. He said, it's got everything to do with me. I'm the one that, you know, can't afford the cost of my housing. Well, he lost the case in terms of they found that, well, 5% he can manage. But what seems amazing in the current climate is that the court, of course, found that it had a legitimate role in ensuring that governments met their commitments. And they found that if the government of Manitoba had not met its commitment to reasonably meet reasonable requirements of adequacy, then they could order the federal government to stop making the transfer payments until it was corrected. So, you know, nobody seemed to think that it was the most radical idea in the world to have a court overseeing a basic government commitment to ensure an adequate level of social assistance. And yet, when we go to court now and argue that under the Charter of Rights, security of the person surely means that people shouldn't be living on the street, subjected to the severe health consequences, sometimes death, living on the street, surely that's a violation of the right to life and security of the person and the right to equality, because look at the effect that these policies have on the people who are protected under Section 15 of our Charter, the equality protection, from policies which adversely affect them. Well, if governments stop dealing with housing and basic security needs, the people who are most harmed are people with disabilities, particularly single mothers and immigrants and racialized groups. Those are the people who are the most affected by poverty. So the UN human rights groups, it's not just the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Human Rights Committee that oversees Canada's compliance with traditional civil and political rights, like the right to life and the right to non-discrimination, has said, you're violating the right to life by not addressing homelessness in Canada, looking at the severe consequences that it has. And there are positive measures required even for the right to life in Canada to address the problem of homelessness, let alone the more substantive obligation for adequate housing, just to meet the standards of the right to life. And similarly, they've talked about the discriminatory consequences of social program cuts of inadequate levels of social assistance. Who suffers? It's single mothers, it's people with disabilities. These are the people that are supposed to be protected from discrimination. So we've come to understand that these are not issues of, you know, governments just not getting it right. These are really issues that fit the human rights paradigm, devaluing people as human beings, vilifying them, subjecting them to stigma and stereotype. It's not really very neutral when you think about it, when you make a decision that somebody's not going to be able to get enough assistance to be able to feed their family. That's not facially neutral, as they call it in human rights language. There's something wrong in terms of basic values when those kinds of decisions are made without thinking about the dignity issues involved and the security of the people whose lives are at stake. And so we've come to realize this is a human rights problem that requires human rights solutions. We have to somehow reclaim our commitment to the kinds of rights that we have really always been committed to. And I have to say, I'm always astonished, and it's happened again today, but when I go around Canada and organize for the next treaty monitoring body or the next review of Canada, and I meet with civil society groups, the commitment to social rights in Canada is absolutely unquestionable. People understand them, they are committed to them, they get them. It's not an issue that Canadians as a whole have somehow abandoned these rights. Somehow people have been convinced that there's nothing they can do anymore. But there is. There's lots we can do. We have to somehow reclaim the rights. I had a friend, Opiata Odindu in Kenya, who's the head of the Social and Economic Rights Center in Nairobi. And Kenya now has strong social and economic rights, the right to housing. We're involved in a case there where a large community being evicted has been guaranteed that they, even in Kenya, that you can't be evicted into homelessness. People are evicted into homelessness all the time, probably 20,000 a year in Ontario for less than a month's rent owed. But in Kenya, South Africa, throughout Latin America, it's been accepted that you don't evict somebody into homelessness. Even if they're illegally occupying land, they're in their in that situation because of their needs. And we have to address the needs, the dignity issues, not just evict people into homelessness. So that's one of the principles of international human rights law that we talked today at the clinic about. Maybe this is something we could start arguing before tribunals here. But at any rate, this was before the constitutional changes in Kenya. And it was a very, it was a negative regime and the courts were bad. But this group that was being evicted insisted that they wanted to go to court and make this argument. And Odindu said, you know, we're not going to win. This is a bad judge. It's a bad court. We're not going to win. And they said, we don't care. We want to make the argument anyway. And so they went in and they made the best argument they could. And the decision was going to come out. And Odindu said, you're going to lose. The whole community showed up, about 300 of them. And they all went into the courtroom. And when the judge started to was going to read the decision, they all started to dance around and celebrate as if they'd won. And I said to Odindu, like, what were they celebrating? I said, it's the first time they'd ever been heard. They got a hearing. They'd occupied what we would call a judicative space. And so we're actually kind of in that moment in Canada where we're going to have to sometimes dance just to claim the spaces that people have taken, that have been taken away from us. And we have to claim them in a lot of different places. We can't just think that the Supreme Court of Canada is going to save us. We've got a challenge to homelessness that is coming from Ontario that is saying, it's trying to take this, we just launched it a few months ago, and already the federal government and the province of Ontario have moved to have it dismissed for no reasonable cause of action. No reasonable cause of action. We're arguing that they haven't done enough to deal with homelessness in Ontario and in Canada, despite 15 years of pleading from UN human rights bodies, from the Senate Committee on Human Rights, from Senator Eggleton's committee, from every expert. You have to have a strategy to address hunger. You have to have a strategy to address homelessness. They refuse to do it. No reasonable cause of action, they're arguing. And, you know, they may win, I don't think so. But, you know, the judges in Canada, compared to the judges we're dealing with in other countries, are not really getting the issues of justice behind us. They're not understanding how serious this is. And when we talk to governments about the concluding observations that are coming from treaty bodies and saying these are serious human rights violations. These are, you know, this is the highest UN body. This is the UN Special Rapporteur. The Special Rapporteur on Housing came 4 or 5 years ago. Maureen Qatari raised huge concerns, said you have to have a housing strategy. Now the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food has been here. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty is coming to Canada in November, Magdalena Sepulveda. These are very serious issues, obviously. I don't need to tell people here, but they are serious human rights issues that should be taken seriously by courts and by governments. So how do we get them to take them seriously? Well, you know, Odindu and his community ended up winning constitutional protections of the right to housing in Kenya by claiming the space, and I think we have to start there. So, you know, where are the spaces that we could claim? I think it is important to argue to reclaim the right to security of the person. The word person is a pretty rich word. When I sat in the Supreme Court of Canada a few years ago with the only poverty case they've ever heard, they've dismissed so many when we sought leave to appeal. They're afraid of the issues, I think. But at any rate, Louise Gosselin was arguing that the inadequate rates that were imposed in Quebec on people who weren't in workfare or participation programs were violating her right to security of the person. And, you know, the courtroom was filled, and I was kind of reminded of my experience as a kid with my grandfather, who was a United Church minister. But it was textual interpretation. It was the idea that, well, what does security of the person mean? It was kind of like reading from the text, you know, everyone has the right to security of the person. And the people that I work with, if I'm to tell them that security of the person doesn't mean any protection from homelessness or not being able to feed your kids. That's ridiculous. That's the most exclusive, elitist, discriminatory idea of what security of the person would mean. So we have to claim these words. These are our rights, and we have to claim. And the commitments that we've made internationally, they don't belong to Stephen Harper. These, when Canada ratifies international treaties, it's with the agreement of provinces. And under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, every level of government has to comply, because Canada can't, as they often do, but they can't under international law say, well, the reason we haven't complied with this treaty is that this is within provincial jurisdiction, we can't do anything about it. That's not an adequate response. You have to ensure somehow that the provinces are complying. And Ontario then has all these obligations. When concluding observations come out from UN treaty bodies that say the level of assistance is inadequate in Ontario, Ontario should be taking this extremely seriously, having committees hold hearings into it. And the Social Assistance Review Commission should certainly be concerned that UN human rights treaty bodies have actually singled out Ontario as an area of concern because of the effect of the cuts here. And that the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food has just said, noticed that 55% of the people using food banks are social assistance. Maybe there's a problem here that needs solving. Maybe that should be part of what the commission is dealing with. But so there are places where we can claim these rights. Really, when I was talking to the clinics today, it's sort of too complicated to go into now, but there's been a convergence internationally of standards which are called the reasonableness standards, where really we can argue that any decision which is made by any administrative body, whether it's a social assistance administrator deciding whether you get emergency assistance or whether you get access to rent bank assistance or the community startup assistance to prevent you from being evicted, whatever decision is being made, it is supposed to now, under jurisprudence from the Supreme Court of Canada, it should be consistent with our international human rights values. That's what the court has said. And so we're actually entitled now to demand that we get reasonable decisions made by everyone, that they're informed by the right to an adequate standard of living. That's how we would change what Amartya Sen talks about, you know, this entitlement system that has failed certain groups of people. We can change it by reinserting these values into the way we make decisions. And we can do that at every level. So, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt said, where do universal human rights start? Close to home. So Hamilton could start. Hamilton could adopt a charter, adopt the notion of the right to an adequate standard of living, and declare that every decision that anybody makes within Hamilton's jurisdiction, whether it's a zoning decision or whether it has to do with administering social programs, to the extent that they have any power, they will make those decisions consistently with the notion that housing is a fundamental right, that everyone should be treated with dignity and respect. And then the provincial government, when it sets social assistance rates, would have to adopt an evidence-based approach and make sure that when they set social assistance rates, they are considering what the true costs are. At all levels, we would start to see a change in the way we're making decisions as a country. And it wouldn't be long before we started to understand that we actually do have an attachment to these traditional values, that we can change things, that these aren't different. It's actually something that, even though it was a global phenomenon of change in the 90s and 2000s that seemed unsolvable, there's actually been a turn, a really important transformation that's occurred internationally. And it has to do really with the recognition of social and economic rights. After Louise Gosselin took her challenge to the Supreme Court of Canada, the decision came out and Louise Arbour and Justice Alain de Bay wrote that said, the right to security of the person has to be interpreted as imposing obligations to ensure that people have an adequate level of social assistance. And the rest of the court actually left it open. They weren't convinced by the facts of that case, but they didn't completely rule it out. But at any rate, Louise Arbour's dissent was a really important event, because a lot of people thought that no one would accept this because our courts have been so conservative. So it was very important. She then was appointed as the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights. And I know that when she arrived, after having heard the Gosselin decision and seen what was happening in Canada, she said, I need to be brought up to speed on social and economic rights. She was, and she really took that on. She was wonderful at the UN. And she worked with NGO coalitions that I was for about 5 or 6 years. We fought for what's called the optional protocol to the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. And what that is it's a complaint procedure that allows people to go to the UN as individuals and say, I've had a right violation. It's not that many people that can go. It's a pretty, you know, it's not anything that's going to change the world. But symbolically, it was huge, because since 1976, there's been a complaints procedure for civil and political rights. And so somebody whose right to freedom of expression was violated in Canada actually can file a complaint with the UN Human Rights Committee and can have that heard by the UN Human Rights Body. But more broadly than that, there is this idea that somehow civil and political rights are different, that you can go to court, you can claim and enforce those rights. But social and economic rights, maybe those are just policy objectives that we should leave to governments. Well, that wasn't working. It's clear that we can't just leave them to governments. It's clear that we had to come up with a different kind of idea. And Louise Arbour understood that. And so she worked with us to try to fight for a complaints procedure that would be the equivalent for social and economic rights. The Canadian government fought tooth and nail against it. They didn't like the idea. They said, no, social and economic rights aren't justiciable, but the African countries and the Latin American countries, they have now been putting social and economic rights in their constitutions. They've been enforcing them in courts. The governments have made themselves accountable. We've had incredible decisions coming out of South Africa where even a progressive government, like the ANC government in South Africa, has agreed to be accountable to courts, which sometimes might have seemed conservative, but they knew that it's not good enough to just end apartheid. It's not good enough to just have civil and political rights. They had to address the social and economic legacy of apartheid and the inequalities. And so they've had right to housing cases and right to health care and so on that have really led the world. Finally, the national system was really probably the most resistant to trying to move to finally agree to this. And in 2008, on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration, finally, with a lot of help from Louise Arbour and others, finally this complaints procedure was put in place for social and economic rights. Louise Arbour talked about it as human rights made whole. And I thought that was a wonderful expression, because really, without that understanding that we have to empower people living in poverty and homelessness to claim and enforce their rights, we haven't really given those people equal status, even within our own human rights movement. If we don't interpret security of the person as dealing with those issues, we haven't given them equal status as people who are rights holders, because their security issues are being ignored. And if we don't start to design programs so that people affected by these human rights violations have a voice and have an ability to go someplace to claim and enforce their rights, then we're really not going to be able to change a system which has silenced them. And so the recognition that's coming from international bodies now is it's not good enough for Canada to say we're committed as a government to creating policies and programs that are supposed to help deal with homelessness and hunger. You have to be committed to the rights. And so the anti-poverty strategies, the housing strategies, they can't just be, well, we'd like to solve homelessness in 10 years and we're going to measure how well we're doing. That's essentially what we've got in most of our housing and anti-poverty strategies in Canada so far. That's not good enough. What's needed is a rights-based approach which gives people the right to identify what's wrong, which gives them a place to go and get some kind of hearing and an effective remedy. And it doesn't need to be courts. It means that whenever anybody makes a decision that could result in hunger or homelessness, we can challenge it and say that's not consistent with our international human rights values. And so we can create ombuds people municipally. We could get the Ontario Human Rights Commission and the Human Rights Tribunal to start dealing with access to adequate housing and freedom from poverty as fundamental human rights. We have to get our courts to have a broader understanding of justice. We have to get our governments to start to take seriously issues when they're raised by UN human rights bodies. It's a whole package. But really, it goes back to things that we're kind of familiar with as Canadians, because I really do think that these are fundamental values. And that at some point, if we start to dance just reclaiming the spaces, at a certain point, we're going to be able to dance because we've started to win. Thanks very much.
Among us today, we have Atif Kabursi, who's a professor emeritus at McMaster University. He teaches economics and he teaches in the arts and science program. We also have Mark Chamberlain here. And he's the former chair of the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction, as well as the former chair of the Hamilton Community Foundation. And we have Laura Katari with us today. She has lived experience with poverty and disability. She's a current roundtable member, vice chair of the Social Assistance Reform Work Group. She's writer and founder of Advocacy Hamilton. So this is an organization that exists to encourage Hamiltonians to participate in a thoughtful discussion regarding issues that face our city. Assistance rates. And then the story becomes critical because it's no longer about worth and entitlement and who deserves what. It becomes about the fact that I am a human being, period. And I am as equal a human being to any other person on this earth. And we have established globally that we have certain values, and those values include an adequate standard to living. I'm not asking for an adequate standard to living. I'm demanding an adequate standard of living. I don't have to ask you for it. I don't have to say thank you for a 1% increase to already inadequate rates. I deserve to be fed and housed so that if you'd like me to be employed, I have the tools and resources to do so. A state of mind that I can move forward and adequately participate as a member of our community. To participate in a way that is meaningful, not to anyone here, but to me. To be self-realized, actualized, to become who I wish to be, not what someone else wishes me to be and mandated so. As a person living with disability, I know what I can accomplish. I know what I need. And as Bruce had mentioned, taking the time and space to actually state it, claiming my place in our community so that I can do what I need to do to move forward and be a whole person, an equal person to every person sitting here and every person that lives in Hamilton, in Ontario, in Canada. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be here tonight. I was absolutely flabbergasted this morning listening to Bruce at the Spectator, and I'm equally impressed and very happy and informed with his ideas that he shared with us. I agree totally with the proposition that this is a human rights issue. This is not charity. We tend to always think of feeding the poor or providing adequate housing as some sort of a gift that we give to people. It's something out, a privilege that we bestow on others. The real way of looking at it, this is a right. And it is a right that is enshrined in what we consider to be a basic human attitude towards our economy, our society, and our participation as citizens. The general proposition is human rights begin with breakfast. You can't possibly think of a hungry person to be a fully active and a fully actualized person. You cannot expect from a hungry person or a person without a home to participate fully and to be free. This freedom becomes absolutely compromised. Because the exigencies and necessities of life would trump any real participation of that person as a fully prepared person to be part of the society. There is a general proposition which is absolutely also true. I mean, I'm going to discuss some economics. I know you're a civilized company here. We should not be talking about these issues. But the story here is that there are lots of economic sense to looking at people and providing them with adequate housing, food, and opportunities. That ultimately we would pay for it, one way or the other, if we were to neglect and to disenfranchise and marginalize people. Because this is going to show back into many dysfunctions and many difficulties. And it would implicate the health system. the social system, the judicial system, that there are costs to all these things, and that what a wise and rational society would do is to make sure that we bear these social costs, because we are going to pay far more if we were not to take adequate care of our people. Economists have really operated on the premise, and these days rationality is not something that I can really share with economists. The premise is extremely simple. The proposition is that we really need to give the rich, because if we give them a break, they will work harder and they will contribute more to society. And the flip side to this is that we should really deny the poor, because then they will work harder in order to earn their survival. On both counts, it's a flawed way of looking at things. The rich, when you give them privileges, you let them get away with things. If you reduce the taxes, they're likely not to spend it invested in your society and your community. They're more likely to spend it probably in Paris or in some other areas on very unnecessary things. And if you were to tax and coax the poor, you're basically going to disenfranchise them, to compromise their capacity to participate and to contribute fully and totally and productively. And there is also an issue here. To a great extent, we tend to think that the poor are somehow poor because it's their responsibility to do something. In many respects, it's the flip side of having distributed unequally, unjustly, so much to people who do not deserve it, and have denied the very people who deserve these things, and who probably, if we had a fair and just system, received a far larger entitlement that would allow them to access their food and their needs and necessities. In many respects,
I noted a couple of questions, and these are the questions that I guess since I've been involved in the issues of poverty for about the last, I guess, 10 years here in Hamilton, and then ultimately across the country with National Council of Welfare, which no longer exists because our federal government believes that all poverty will be solved by creating jobs. And I question, when I think of those who are living in poverty in Hamilton, when we looked at the demographic of 25,000 kids in poverty of 100,000, another 15,000 on ODSP, and 15 to some odd thousand who are seniors, and 15,000 or more people who are living in poverty who actually are working, one would look at that and say, creating more jobs doesn't necessarily help those who are kids, seniors, disabled, and already working. So there's something more fundamental in terms of dealing with poverty than simply that. And it's interesting, too, is when you look at the most recent Commission on Mental Illness and some of the solutions they speak to in terms of dealing with mental illness, which includes also income. Again, when you look at the solutions suggested by our federal government today, that creating more jobs clearly will also solve mental illness, if that's the case. So it is the question that you asked, I think, for me, that was really important was, how did this happen? And how do we reclaim that space, or have we convinced ourselves that there's nothing we can do? So, you know, I guess maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago, I was with the group here in Hamilton looking and saying, what else do we, what do we need to do? What do we need to know, and what else do we need to learn? And I've actually taken that when I speak now to, our minister in Toronto for the province about the adequacy of social assistance rates. And inaction at all levels, including individuals, by the way, this is not just governments, but individuals, because we can go across the country and we can say, years ago we said 80-90% of the population in Canada would suggest that poverty is the number one issue, that we need to deal with that as a human right. But the second question that should have been asked, and I don't think it was, would you pay more for a cup of coffee? And that's part of the problem, is that there's an individual issue, but there's also a government issue. And the government issue, when we start talking about, say, for example, social assistance rates, and by the way, one of the things that was told to me 10 years ago, that the one number one issue to deal with poverty, at least at the first order, the first level, is income. Plain and simple, it's income. And we can get as complex as we want about a whole bunch of other things and a whole bunch of other programs, et cetera, complexity. But the number one issue, if you want to raise all the boats very quickly and solve a lot of the issues, you got to deal with income. So when we think of social assistance and we think about things of that nature, it is critical. So my questions kind of follow along the lines of, what else do we need to know to act? What else do we need to know? And so I too begin with a human rights, with a moral, with a value system. I think all, what you call companies, societies, are built fundamentally on that. And what differentiates us today from civilizations in the past or country by country, purely and simply, is our values. That's what differentiates us. But what is that gap? And I think there is a gap between what we believe and what we actually do. And that, to me, is the huge gap. And why is that? Why is there such a gap? So I ask it, what else do we need to know about poverty and context of health? Now, in Hamilton, and I speak about Hamilton when I speak across the country, and I say, you know, I don't want to disparage Hamilton, because Hamilton, by the way, just is way ahead in knowing ourselves. But it's like this in every single city and every single country. That is, if you have not invested into your social determinants of health, we have not invested in things like housing, like income, like early years education, like the ability to associate, you will have horrible health outcomes. And I would suggest in Canada, in Ontario, for example, I make the statement, we have a horrible, horrible healthcare system. Horrible. We have a phenomenal illness care system. We are great at taking care of people when they're sick. We're really lousy at preventing people from getting sick. Because if we were, we would not have poverty. We would not have inadequate income. We would not have inadequate housing. All people would have opportunity for education. We would be investing into our early years. We'd be investing in our kids. Dr. Jean Clinton in Hamilton is very clearly, a child's brain development doesn't wait for funding. We know that. So what else do we know about the health? We know about it in terms of kills people. We know that it makes them ill. We know that they use the healthcare system more. We know that baby birth weights are lower. We know all these things. These are facts. Now, if they're not believed, then my question is, what else do we need to know? We can do that study. We can look for that evidence. What else do we need to know? Then you look at it from a health or from a cost perspective. Now, the National Council of Welfare, maybe this is why they stopped us, is we wrote a report that brought together this idea of what is the cost of not dealing with poverty. Now, really interesting, in Canada, because we have an open and accessible healthcare system, you can basically say that everything we don't invest into properly in our communities, whether it be from an environmental perspective, whether it be from a health perspective and social determinant investment perspective, shows up sooner or later in the emergency room, almost always. Now, the point is we can actually measure that. We can measure the cost because of the cost of our healthcare system. And what's really interesting, I find, is that when the Ontario government, which by the way, I think have done some phenomenal things, however, when they began our program in Ontario for poverty reduction, there was a very interesting report that they waited for before they announced. And it was a report from the Ontario Food Banks. And it suggested this huge, huge cost, I'm talking huge cost, billions and billions and billions of dollars by not addressing the issue of poverty. And that report was reviewed to and basically signed off by a fellow by the name of Don Drummond, who was the guy that came in and actually did our entire report to talk about austerity just most recently. Don Drummond, basically offering up something completely opposite to what he was signing off to 4 or 5 years ago in the report from the Ontario Food Banks. So what else do we need to know about the cost? Do we need to know more that it's costing us almost double in billions of dollars to not address poverty? Do we not believe the numbers? Do we need more studies? Every province in the country and every OECD country that's looked at this in a meaningful way will show very clearly that poverty is expensive and that inequality is also very, very expensive. So what else do we need to know? I would suggest to you today we don't need to know any more at all. We know it. We know the answers. The answer, by the way, is pretty straightforward. And this is where the big gap falls, in my view, in terms of action versus what we believe. It comes down to leadership. It's not that the answers aren't known. It's that political leadership don't know how to sell it. They don't know how to sell it. They don't know how to sell a living wage. Because you have a whole bunch of folks that are saying, well, if you have living wage, we're going to lose a lot of jobs. That's not true. It's not true. And if we actually had leadership that suggested that health and overall cost coming down is our actual goal, if productivity, if creativity, if prosperity, if competitiveness were actually our goals, which we state they are, poverty wouldn't exist. They couldn't exist in that kind of community, in that kind of society. We make the argument about living wage all the time and minimum wage as though it's going to lose jobs, but I would suggest to you that when you shake the hand or buy something from someone who's making a minimum wage, thank them. Thank them for subsidizing your purchase and the profits of the organization, that they are subsidizing that with their health, because that's what they're doing. So the solution, it's quite interesting. When you speak like this, people call you a socialist. Now, it's really quite interesting. In my businesses, and I run businesses, okay, we invest in our people. That's our number one investment, in our people. We invest in them in terms of very good incomes. We invest in them in terms of their health and wellness. Because if they're healthy and they're well, and we worry about their overall wellness, not just by when they're at the job, they do great things. And when people and companies do great things, your company does great things. And if your company does great things, guess what people say? Mark, you're a great capitalist. If I take that same attitude into the community and say, let's invest in the people. Let's help people make sure that they're well, that they're all meeting the maximum potential of themselves, that they actually help and provide not just jobs, by the way, but even volunteering and creating the environment and communities that help create great jobs, that we actually value that. As soon as I start talking like that, they call me a socialist. We've got to lose the name calling. We need to go back to the evidence. We need to look at what is actually available for us to design a community that we actually want, because that's what we're saying. And we've got to start educating, and I mean educating the leaders, that this is absolutely possible and it's a much better place at the end of the road. Thank you.
I'd like to start with a little story. Recent history took a cab ride to Standard Life Building. I was going to attend a roundtable meeting. And the cab driver asked me if I worked in the Standard Life Building. I said, no, I'm attending a meeting of the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction. And you'd think, after I said that, it somehow triggered in him this litany of abuses against people in poverty. He felt free to tell me what good-for-nothings, what lazy bums they were, how they were not deserving of a penny of his hard-earned money. How these people, he saw them yesterday. He saw them because they were taking cab rides because they just got their checks and they're getting beer with my money. And he saw them on the sidewalks yesterday. And he was quite sure yesterday was the day that they all came out because they all got their checks. And they were out there with their grocery carts and their fat bottoms. And I swear I was so happy I only had a 7-block cab ride. I was so happy that I could get out of there because I was a member of the roundtable, he had no idea that I actually had lived experience with poverty myself. And I'm sure if I had told him, he said, well, it's not you really that I'm talking about, it's those other people. And so as I went to go step out of the cab, I turned to him and I said, by the way, yesterday was not check day for anyone in Ontario. Yesterday was a Thursday and it's quite possible people were just getting paid. And he said, no, I know what I saw. And I said, no, it was not check day. I am sure you saw exactly what you're saying you saw. Those are just Hamiltonians. And I stepped out of the cab and closed the door. And usually the moral to this story, though you might think, just not tell anyone I'm a member of the roundtable, but that's not true, I'm a proud member. You'd think the moral of the story was don't confuse class and income and people's behaviors and ascribe them with a stereotype
to poverty. And usually that is the moral of my story with this story. Until we start looking at our international human rights obligations, and we talk about social assistance reform in Ontario, and we talk about evidence-based social assistance rates. And then the story becomes critical, because it's no longer about worth and entitlement and who deserves what. It becomes about the fact that I am a human being, period. And I am as equal a human being to any other person on this earth. And we have established globally that we have certain values, and those values include an adequate standard to living. I'm not asking for an adequate standard to living. I'm demanding an adequate standard of living. I don't have to ask you for it. I don't have to say thank you for a 1% increase to already inadequate rates. I deserve to be fed and housed so that if you'd like me to be employed, I have the tools and resources to do so. A state of mind that I can move forward and adequately participate as a member of our community. To participate in a way that is meaningful, not to anyone here, but to me. To be self-realized, actualized, to become who I wish to be, not what someone else wishes me to be and mandated so. As a person living with disability, I know what I can accomplish. I know what I need. And as Bruce had mentioned, taking the time and space to actually state it, claiming my place in our community so that I can do what I need to do to move forward and be a whole person, an equal person to every person sitting here and every person that lives in Hamilton, in Ontario, in Canada. Thank you.
My name is Michelle Harashka. I'm a community activist. I've been on workers' rights and poverty issues in the city for a number of years now. So I welcome the comments from all the panelists. However, after the G20, everybody saw the violence there from the police and whatnot, there was an interesting video that was placed on YouTube. And the gist of the video was that the UN Declaration of Human Rights is not really law. Thus, meaning that all these horrible things, famines, war, people starving, if it was actual law, then these things would not be going on. So I would like to see a push that it's actually made into a law and not just words on a paper. The other thing I would like to state that I don't think people really understand the history of the labor movement and the working class and some of the troubles and trials that they've gone through. So I was been reading a book. So today there was a letter to the Spectator and talking about Dofasco being different than the workers at Stelco. And I interjected a comment that in 1908 was the first public pension by Grand Trunk Railway in Montreal, and that was actually a control issue to control the workers from unionizing, and it was managed by the president, vice president, and a couple other high stakes within the company to make all the decisions. So there was no uniform rules. You could be not get to, if you were injured, if you were deemed as responsible for causing your own accident or injury, you would not get those pension funds. On from 1908, with the selling of general annuities at the back at the time, that it was the poor people or the low-income working class could not afford them and afford them, and only the middle class did. So let's kind of move ahead. In 1979, government passed substantial reform to health and safety legislation, which was completely dismantled by the Harris government. So as a member of Steel City Solidarity, as a direct action group. We've helped 4 people to date on stolen wages. So even if you go through the process of having all your paperwork from the Ministry of Labor, that still doesn't ensure that you're going to get paid. So thus the need for direct action. I also believe that there has to be a building of solidarity within the community. So no matter where you are, what your interests are, that it's the same, what I call the spider, at a global level that's controlling everything. And it's seeping into our government, where government no longer represents the people. And I think that's where you're getting the frustration from people, the low voter turnouts, because they just don't believe that whatever party is there, they're not representing the needs of the people. So there definitely has to be reform in that area. So I wish you luck. I'm going to still continue on the ground and build solidarity.
Thank you.
The whole issue of the way in which human rights approaches in the past have kind of ignored the issue of resource distribution and allocation and are now really engaging with it as a fundamental issue. It's never made sense to me that this element of governmental decision making is seen as somehow immune from the need for accountability to values and human rights standards, because in fact it's not that the government is redistributing things so much as the decisions that governments make end up having an impact on how things are distributed, and whatever decisions they're making, they are distributing resources, as you're saying. These are some of the most important decisions that governments make, and they're some of the ones with the greatest impacts on people's basic dignity and security and human rights, and they're decisions that need to have be supervised in order to ensure that marginal groups and groups without power and voice are not neglected. And so I think it very much fits in the human rights framework, and there's a lot of work going on now where budget analysis is being brought into a human rights framework, and we will get to the point where we can more meaningfully hold governments accountable for their decisions about who's taxed, for how much, and how the resources are distributed, because that's really what determines so much.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Canada is known for being extremely rich in resources. Actually, if you were to value water at its scarcity value, every Canadian born would be worth more than $1 million. I know some of you would like to cash that now. But there is one basic problem, and this is at the heart of these resources, is that we have always approached these resources as some sort of a gift from nature, and we can distribute it. I mean, we're not processing enough. We're not adding value to it. And to a great extent, much of the resources we have are foreign-owned. We have literally mortgaged much of our resources. But you have a very fundamental point, whether it's on resources or anything else. We need to have a better, more equitable distribution of income and wealth. There is poverty because some people are overly rich. Some people are getting less because some are getting far more than they should. There is enough wealth in this country and in the world, actually, that we can distribute in a more equitable way and get everybody their fair say, their fair shake, their fair share.
What I think is very important right now is Bill C-38. People don't know what that bill is about, but poverty and housing's in it. And it's on its second reading. If you're interested in finding out more, Council of Canadians will be more than willing to fill you in. In fact, they're doing a demonstration out in front of David Sweet's MP's office in Dundas tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. And they have another rally planned, I think, for June 20th. Contact Council of Canadians and they'll fill you in more. This is a dangerous bill. Harper is carrying on as if it's his country, his government. He is so far removed from the reality of poverty, the reality of weather and climate change and how that makes people sick, bad air, etc. All the reasons that people do get on disability and do get terrible diseases is the mind think of a Harper government. It's confusing to me. So you can talk about the Liberals. They're not a lot different, but we've lost democracy, and that is the most important thing that's gone wrong here. What we fought for as Canadians, our grandparents. I mean, all those reasons that those people behind us fought was to make sure we had social programs in place so that if you were down on your luck or something happened, you could survive until you got back on your feet. We don't have that anymore. We don't. I heard the gentleman here talking about dehousing people. That's what we do in Canada. But I just wanted to point out that there is a meeting tomorrow, David Sweet's office. Pay attention to Bill 38. If we don't get that Bill 38 under control, we're spinning our tires, definitely spinning our tires on anything else.
A lot of what I've heard in the past year and a half, and especially working through the roundtable and people knowing about it and coming to me and literally yelling at me that there is absolutely nothing we can do, so why am I wasting my time? I've been told I am wasting my time. And to be quite honest, one of the biggest driving forces besides my own well-being is something a high school teacher told me. Believe it or not, something stuck in my head from high school. There was value in high school. And she said to me, if you do not fight for your rights, if you take them for granted, if you stand down, and it doesn't matter what right it is, whether it's voting rights, whether it's rights around housing and security, it doesn't matter which right. The moment we abdicate our responsibility to stand up and demand them, we lose them. So yes, go to David Sweet's office. Do whatever you can do as an individual. Come together collectively. Do things. Take up space in the judicial system, whatever way or means that you have, if you're an artist and you do spoken word, if it's music, every little bit counts. The polls show it. More and more people are getting dissatisfied with the way the country is run and values that are being ignored. Keep speaking up. Be angry and use that anger to fuel your way forward.
I think we have time for just one more question, so you have the last word.
Okay. I just wanted to say it's just not the adequate disability rates. The system is very, very punitive, and we get cut off of our system just because I don't know why, but the $5.99 that the single people get is often only maybe 5 or 6 months, and then they get suspension letters to cut them off at the end of the month. And that's why the landlord-tenant courts are overflowing. And I appreciate the point you made, Mr. Porter. I didn't take the thought far enough to the children that are then going from school to school to school. And I was actually one of those children. School to school, because we had to keep moving. So I think we have to keep in mind it's not just the inadequacy of rates. There's also a very punitive, surveillance-laden system overseeing it. And to my mind, that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. Why can't that money be given to the poor? Why do we have to police them and torture them and punish them and send them on wild goose chases to get information that they've already provided several times? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a punitive system. It's terrible. That's why mental illness is on the rise. That's what I have to say.
All good comments from people that are living on the policies and the changes this government is making. I later attended a different town hall meeting, one that was put together by the Hamilton branch of Council of Canadians. They've been very active around informing groups about Bill C-38. They have three panelists, and then the floor was given to those in the audience. One woman told me in hostile terms to shut my camera off. She then told the small gathering about the cuts that were coming to old age pensions, how terrible it was going to be in the future, trying to get by on a pension that the government controls. It was the most revealing comment that was said that day. But once again, only those few people in the audience were to hear it. Then various people made comments of concern about how few people knew what was going on and how could they reach out to more people. Makes me want to give my head a shake. Sometimes I really feel like I'm wasting my time doing this job, trying to get the information and the concerns from the community on air for more people to hear. People are getting angry and they're getting frustrated, but I'm not the one to take your frustrations out on. I want to thank the listeners that do take my show seriously and do understand why I'm at a meeting.
This has been The Other Side of the News, and thanks for listening.
Redefining Radio.
Sync FM.